Part 1. Phil. Chapter 1. My friend, Nicholas Brady, who in his own mind helped save the world, was born in Chicago in 1928, but then moved right to California. Most of his life was spent in the Bay Area, especially in Berkeley. He remembered the metal hitching posts in the shape of horses' heads in front of the old houses in the hilly part of the city, and the electric red trains that met the ferries, and most of all, the fog. Later, by the 40s, the fog had ceased to lie over Berkeley in the night. Originally, Berkeley, at the time of the red trains and the streetcars, was quiet and underpopulated except for the university, with its illustrious rat houses and fine football team. As a child, Nicholas Brady took in a few football games with his father, but he never understood them. He could not even get the team song right. But he did like the Berkeley campus, with the trees and quiet groves and Strawberry Creek. Most of all, he liked the sewer pipe through which the creek ran. The sewer pipe was the best thing on the campus. In summer, when the creek was low, he crawled up and down it. One time, some people called him over and asked if he was a college student. He was 11 years old then. I asked him once why he chose to live his life out in Berkeley, which by the 40s had become overcrowded, noisy, and afflicted by angry students who fought it out at the co-op market as if the stacks of canned food were barricades. "Shit, Phil," Nicholas Brady said. "Berkeley is my home." People who gravitated to Berkeley believed that, even if they had only been there a week. They claimed no other place existed. This became particularly true when the coffee houses opened up on Telegraph Avenue and the free speech movement started. One time, Nicholas was standing in line at the co-op on Grove and saw Mario Savio in line ahead of him. Savio was smiling and waving at admirers. Nicholas was on campus the day the fuck sign was held up in the cafeteria, spelled P-H-U-Q-U-E, and the cops busted the guys holding it. However, he was in the bookstore browsing and missed the whole thing. Although he lived in Berkeley forever and ever, Nicholas attended the university for only 2 months, which made him different from everyone else. The others attended the university in perpetuity. Berkeley had an entire population of professional students who never graduated and who had no other goal in life. Nicholas's nemesis vis-a-vis the university was ROTC, which in his time was still going strong. As a child, Nicholas had gone to a progressive or communist front nursery school. His mother, who had many friends in the Communist Party in Berkeley in the 30s, sent him there. Later, he became a Quaker, and he and his mother sat around in friends' meeting the way Quakers do, waiting for the Holy Spirit to move them to speak. Nicholas subsequently forgot all that, at least until he enrolled at Cal and found himself given an officer's uniform and an M1 rifle. Thereupon, his unconscious fought back, burdened by old memories. He damaged the gun and could not go through the manual of arms. He came to drill out of uniform. He got failing grades. He was informed that failing grades in ROTC meant automatic expulsion from Cal, to which Nicholas said, "What's right is right." However, instead of letting them expel him, he quit. He was 19 years old and his academic career was ruined. It had been his plan to become a paleontologist. The other big university in the Bay Area, which was Stanford, cost far too much for him. His mother held the minor post of clerk for the U.S. Department of Forestry in a building on campus. She had no money. Nicholas faced going to work. He really hated the university and thought of not returning his uniform. He thought of showing up at drill with a broom and insisting it was his M1 rifle. He never thought of firing the M1 rifle at his superior officers, though. The firing pin was missing. Nicholas, in those days, was still in touch with reality. The matter of returning his officer's uniform was solved when the university authorities opened his gym locker and took the uniform out of it, including both shirts. Nicholas had been formally severed from the military world. Moral objections, more thoughts of brave demonstrations, vanished from his head, and in the fashion of students attending Cal, he began roaming the streets of Berkeley. His hands stuck in the back pockets of his Levi's, gloom on his face, uncertainty in his heart, no money in his wallet, no definite future in his head. He still lived with his mother, who was tired of the arrangement. He had no skills, no plans, only inchoate anger. As he walked along, he sang a left-wing marching song from the International Brigade of the Loyalist Army of Spain, a communist brigade made up mostly of Germans. The song went, "Vor Marvid im Schützengraben, in der Stund der Gefahr, mit den eisernen Brigaden,
Sein Herz wohl has geladen, stand Hans der Kommissar. The line he liked best was, Sein Herz wohl has geladen, which meant, his heart full of hate. Nicholas sang that over and over again as he strode along Berkeley Way, down to Shattuck, and then up Dwight Way back to Telegraph. Nobody noticed him, because what he was doing was not unusual in Berkeley at that time. One often saw as many as 10 students striding along in jeans, singing left-wing songs and pushing people out of the way. At the corner of Telegraph and Channing, the woman behind the counter at University Music waved at him, because Nicholas often hung around there browsing through the records. So he went inside.
"You don't have your uniform on," the woman said.
"I've dropped out of the fascist university," Nicholas said, which certainly was true. Pat excused herself to wait on a real customer, so he took an album of the Firebird Suite into a listening booth and put on the side where the giant egg cracks open. It fitted his mood, although he was not certain what came out of the egg. The picture on the album cover just showed the egg, and someone with a spear, evidently going to break the egg. Later on, Pat opened the door of the listening booth, and they talked about his situation.
"Maybe Herb would hire you here," Pat said. "You're in the store all the time. You know the stock, and you know a lot about classical music."
"I know where every record in the store is," Nicholas said, excited at the idea.
"You'd have to wear a suit and tie."
"I have a suit and tie," Nicholas said. Going to work for University Music at 19 was probably the greatest move of his life, because it froze him into a mold that never broke, an egg that never opened, or at least did not open for 25 more years, an awfully long time for someone who had really never done anything but play in the parks of Berkeley, go to the Berkeley Public Schools, and spend Saturday afternoons at the Kiddies' Matinee at the Oaks Theater on Solano Avenue, where they showed a newsreel, a selected short subject, and two cartoons before the regular subject, all for 11 cents. Working for University Music on Telegraph Avenue made him part of the Berkeley scene for decades to come and shut off all possibilities of growth or knowledge of any other life, any larger world. Nicholas had grown up in Berkeley, and he remained in Berkeley, learning how to sell records and later how to buy records, how to interest customers in new artists, how to refuse taking back defective records, how to change the toilet paper roll in the bathroom behind the number 3 listening booth. It became his whole world. Bing Crosby and Frank Sinatra and Ella Mae Morse, Oklahoma and later South Pacific, and Open the Door, Richard, and If I'd Known You Were Coming, I'd Have Baked a Cake. He was behind the counter when Columbia bought out LP Records. He was opening cartons from the distributors when Mario Lanza appeared, and he was checking inventory and back orders when Mario Lanza died. He personally sold 5,000 copies of Jan Pierce's Bluebird of Happiness, hating each copy. He was there when Capitol Records went into the classical music line and when their classical music line folded. He was always glad he had gone into the retail record business because he loved classical music and loved being around records all the time, selling them to customers he personally knew and buying them at discount for his own collection. But he also hated the fact that he had gone into the record business because he realized the first day he was told to sweep the floor that he would be a semi-janitor, semi-clerk the rest of his life. He had the same mixed attitude toward it he had had toward the university and toward his father. Also, he had the same mixed attitude toward Herb Jackman, his boss, who was married to Pat, an Irish girl. Pat was very pretty and a lot younger than Herb, and Nicholas had a heavy crush on her for years and years, up until the time they all became older and did a lot of drinking together at Hambone Kelly's, a cabaret in El Cerrito that featured Lou Waters and his Dixieland jazz band. I met Nicholas for the first time in 1951, after Lou Waters' band had become Turk Murphy's band and signed up with Columbia Records. Nicholas often came into the bookstore where I worked during his lunch hour to browse among the used copies of Proust and Joyce and Kafka, the used textbooks the students at the university sold us after their courses. And their interest in literature ended. Cut off from the university, Nicholas Brady bought the used textbooks from the poli-sci and literature classes that he could never attend. He had quite a knowledge of English lit, and it wasn't very long before we got to talking, became friends, and finally became roommates in an upstairs apartment in a brown shingle house on Bancroft Way, near his store and mine. I had just sold my first science fiction story to Tony Boucher at a magazine called Fantasy and Science Fiction for $75, and was considering quitting my job as book clerk and becoming a full-time writer, something I subsequently did. Science fiction writing became my career.